ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife History.
Well, back at this time of the year, the first couple of weeks of December in 1941, Australians' world changed dramatically. We'd been at war with Germany and its allies, but that was over there in Europe. And then suddenly, conflict came a lot closer to home.
Out of a clear sky came the treacherous Japanese attack on Hawaii. The homes of Waikiki, famous in song, are burning fiercely from the bombs dropped by those planes. The whole world knows now how Japan assaulted the American naval base without warning, without a declaration of war, and while her envoys were actually negotiating in Washington. No wonder the people of Hawaii were bewildered by this sudden, unexpected blow.
Yes, indeed. Everything changed. The Japanese attacks on Pearl Harbor, not just on the US in Hawaii, of course, but also British holdings in Malaya and Hong Kong and other Pacific targets made World War II a truly global conflict. And what was the Australian home front like in the week before and after? To tell us some more about this epic slice of Australian history, we're joined once again by Michael Adams. He's the creator and host of the Forgotten Australia podcast. Michael joins us fortnightly with these flashbacks, looking at what was happening in particular weeks across the years. Michael, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening,
welcome
Phil.
Back to Nightlife.
Thanks for having me.
So Australians, well, we certainly knew we were at war in the first week of December, but things were about to get a lot worse. Came just very close to home, didn't it?
It did indeed. It was sort of a out of the frying pan into the fire situation. Thinking about this week back in 1941, or this sort of, you know, first part of December 1941, it's hard to think of another time as dark in Australian history, as sort of shocking. The bad news just kept on coming. So on the 19th of November, off the coast of Western Australia, the light cruiser Sydney had been sunk by the German merchant raider Cormoran. And like while that had happened on the 19th of November, it was a few days before Sydney was missed. And then it was a few more days before German survivors were picked up and the horrible truth became known that all 645 Australians aboard the ship had been lost. 318 of the 399 Germans had survived and been rescued. And of course, wartime censorship was such that this information wasn't made public immediately. The authorities did start to contact the next of kin, sent them, you know, telegrams saying your blokes are missing. And that meant rumours were starting to circulate. And on the 30th of November, Prime Minister John Curtin announced that Sydney was missing, presumed lost. So that made news on the first day of December. And Australia was just completely shocked and in grief. It was more than 35% of all naval losses in World War II happened from this one sinking. Just a hideous, hideous event. And so that was, you know, terrible news. And then the very next day, it was revealed that the HMAS Parramatta had been sunk off the coast of Tobruk and some 138 guys out of 162 had been lost. So there was this real 1-2 punch of bad war news. You know, the Sun sort of editorial said, on a tragic week, the death of 800 gallant Australians has been announced. So this was, you know, coming up to Christmas. There was still hope, you know, the families still had hope that some of their loved ones might be picked up, you know, in lifeboats or maybe they'd made it to the coast. So the newspapers were filled with these horrible plaintive photographs of, you know, young wives with babies hoping against hope that, you know, the husband, the father, the brother, the son would be found alive. And of course that wasn't to be. So it was a really a dark time. And then, you know, competing for headlines was the, you know, terrible all-out warfare in Ukraine between the Russians and the Nazis, and then this relentless drumbeat in the Pacific as, you know, President Roosevelt was giving an ultimatum to the Japanese to sort of, you know, de-escalate, demilitarize in the sort of, you know, what was then called the Indochina sort of area of the Pacific. So it was an incredibly tense time, you know, all in the lead up to Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. The loss of the HMAS Parramatta is less remembered, isn't it? Even though, of course, completely tragic off the coast of Tobruk.
I guess the thing was, it was on the other side of the world. It was sort of in what was considered, because, you know, the siege of Tobruk was that day broken. So the Tobruk had been a focus for a long time. I guess it was kind of seen as being further away. The circumstances were understood. It had been torpedoed by a U-boat. There had been survivors, so they could say what had happened, whereas the HMAS Sydney's fate would be a mystery for an awfully long time.
For a very long time, yeah.
And one thing we do see on the, I think, the 4th of December in the Sun, you know, after they'd picked up the German survivors, there was this headline, you know, front page, "Were Sydney men machine gunned in water?" And that was the idea that, you know, that there had been survivors, but they'd been shot in cold blood by the Germans. This conspiracy theory would circulate for decades, and it was eventually disproved. But it's interesting, given that, you know, in the news today, we're debating this very thing about, you know, shooting people, blowing people up in the water. So right then it was considered, you know, that so many Germans had survived was sort of almost like rubbing salt into this very, very raw wound at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it seems now, from what we know now, the plain fact is that there was, you know, mistakes were made. The HMAS Sydney got too close.
That's right.
And got stuck. Got
exactly.
Trapped.
Yeah.
Cormoran pulled down its disguises and opened fire at not quite point blank range,
but pretty close.
But pretty close.
Yeah, exactly. So a real tragedy. But of course, you know, the Christmas has to continue on. I mean, the shops were all advertising their, you know, Christmas gear for kids. It's so funny. It's like, you know, I saw an article on CNN today about, you know, the dangers of AI-enabled teddy bears that, you know, might tell your kid to burn the house down. It was a kind of gentler time, at least in the toy department back in 1941. We see an ad for the Farmer's Department Store that's headlined, "Santa Panders to Young Moderns." So Bobby obviously wants a little metal car. And, you know, Jill, being a girl, wants a little doll that, you know, has an unbreakable composite head but also can say mama. So a simpler time in some respects.
Yeah. It was December the 8th in Australia that Pearl Harbor, the news from Pearl Harbor broke. It was a working day.
It was. It was Monday morning.
Monday morning.
Yeah.
So what happened in the immediate aftermath? I mean, there must have been a lot of people. Did we get full information about it?
Yeah, pretty well. Yeah. Full information in terms of the absolute sort of conflagration that had engulfed much of the Pacific. The news came through at 5:30 on the Monday morning. Originally, I think it was picked up from a BBC broadcast. It was soon, like, you know, people woke up to the news on the radio all around Australia that day. It wasn't like it was, I mean, I guess the extent of the attack was a surprise. But, you know, the night before, the Sydney Sun's headline was "Pacific Explosion Feared, Anxious Night Vigil of War Ministers." So pretty much people thought there was going to be war with Japan. They just didn't expect that, you know, Pearl Harbor would be bombed, that Singapore would be, the Malaya would be invaded, Hong Kong, Manila, and so forth. So this sort of multi-pronged attack became, you know, was a huge surprise. And, you know, the Sun that day, its headline was "Pacific Ablaze, Japs Bomb Singapore and USA Bases." So, it, you know, what had been an immense second European war had just become a full world war, and it was viewed as a war of total extermination. So, you know, there were in the week beforehand, the Australian authorities, military authorities, government authorities had kind of reassured people, yep, we're completely prepared for any eventuality. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, actually we're not. People didn't know what they should do if there was an air raid, which suddenly seemed to be a real possibility. Was there enough food? Petrol rationing was instigated almost immediately. Would Christmas travel still be permitted? There were so many questions, and the government was kind of responding, you know, in real time, trying to reassure people that they knew what they were doing. And it was also, the big question was, you know, who would be called up, what sort of age groups, and what would they have to do? And of course, you know, one thing they had prepared for was rounding up Japanese living in the city. So they were rounded up by detectives and military intelligence within minutes or even hours of Pearl Harbor news sort of being made public. And they were, you know, whisked off to internment camps.
Well, Christmas wasn't exactly cancelled, but it was It was a more somber affair, I'm sure.
It certainly was. I mean, you know, there was, within days, one of the hot items was bags of sand. You could spend a shilling for a sugar sack filled with sand. There were sand depots. These would be used, you know, for barricades against bomb blasts, but also to put out fires from, you know, supposed, you know, incendiary devices being dropped by planes. There was a black market in blackout window material. There was, you know, articles about what to do when, if there was an air raid. And one of the big bits of advice, which seems fairly common sense, but in London it had been a real problem, was when there was news of planes above, people would run outside to see, to look up or go to the windows, and that really increased your chances of being injured or killed.
Yep.
So it was a very much a rapid learning experience, but it also meant that, you know, very quickly, Australia would look to America and our international relations would be forever changed.
I'm talking with Michael Adams, creator and host of the Forgotten Australia podcast. Crime, of course, did not take a break. It rarely does. True crime is still evident. Sydney saw two sensational murder cases in the early week, in the first week of December, didn't they, that left four people dead.
Indeed. The first one happened on the 1st of December, 1941. A woman in her mid-30s, Vera Watt, was going out to the pictures with her daughter in Manly, and the daughter found some Bex tablets, Bex sachets in the letterbox. And Mum was a very keen user of Bex, and she thought that they were samples. So she said, beauty, and she took two of them just in case she was going to get a headache. I mean, a lot of people did this at this time with Bex and APC powders. She and the daughter got on the bus. They were on the way to Manly. The mum started to feel really sick. She started to go into spasms. She had to be helped off the bus. She was in a Manly chemist when she fell to the floor. She was whisked to the hospital and was dead 2 hours later. Of course, you know, the daughter told police what had happened. They analysed the remains of the Bex sachets. They also did an autopsy, of course, and it turned out that she'd been poisoned with strychnine.
Dear oh dear.
Yeah, absolutely dear oh dear. So this is, you know, it's always interesting to me that these sort of cases unfold against this, you know, massive world historic events. I mean, the rest of Australia is coming to grips with the Sydney sink being, you know, lost, and this woman's being, you know, murdered in Manly. And detectives, of course, have got to try and get to the bottom of it. They very quickly came up with the suspect, and he was arrested. His name was Conald Donald Paget. He'd actually been this woman Vera's old flame back in the day, before she'd gotten married, before she'd had a couple of kids, and before her first husband had died. So Vera and Conald had reunited, and she'd kind of become his de facto wife, even though he was already married. Then in mid-1941, she'd fallen pregnant. He would not agree to an abortion. She was going to have a newborn as well as having these two kids who are like 9 and 10, so she'd be unable to work. So what she did was she found her husband through a marriage agency, and this guy, Daniel Watt, was unemployed at this point, but he'd soon become a soldier and be in a Sydney garrison. And Conald Paget was furious that Vera had sort of, you know, decided to break it off with him, and he apparently harassed her. Made sort of prank phone calls, all sorts of threats, sent letters. His family knew about this affair, so it was very tangled. And, you know, this guy in October of 1941 had even gone to the police and sort of claimed that Vera and her new husband were cocaine addicts. There was nothing to this. So he was really in the frame for this murder. He was arrested. He was charged. He would be put to committal hearing and ordered to stand trial. And that wouldn't happen until February of next year, in February of 1942. But just in the lead up to the trial, it was no build.
Really?
They dropped the case, yeah. So it was kind of, they didn't really say why, except, you know, you've got to sort of assume that they didn't have enough evidence against him. I mean, poisoning is very difficult to prove under a lot of circumstances, but particularly in this case where, you know, it had just been left in a letterbox, the defence could say anybody would have done that. So, yeah, her case would be a cold case, would go unsolved.
On Monday, the 8th of December, just hours after Australia learned of the Japanese attacks, crooks used dynamite to blow a railway pay train off its tracks south of Sydney. They ended up killing three guards, but they were making off with the cash that was stashed in a safe.
This one pardon the pun, no pun intended, blew me away when I was reading about 1941 in the papers and saw this case and was like, how do we not know about this one? And of course, the answer is because it happened just hours after Pearl Harbor became public. Yeah. So back in 1941, the New South Wales rail system was the second biggest employer in Australia after the military. So to get people paid, they had these pay cars, pay buses, which were actually petrol driven, sort of one carriage devices that went along the railway lines and, you know, handed out the pays to various gang bosses along the line. So this pay car on the morning of Monday, the 8th of December, just hours after the news about Pearl Harbor had broken, it was chugging along with three veteran railway workers, a driver, a guard and a paymaster, all of whom were armed with revolvers. They were at Yandera, sort of south of Mittagong, going around a curve, and all of a sudden this five-ton vehicle was blown off the tracks at this curve. It went like 100 feet along above the tracks and then toppled down an embankment. One of the driver was thrown, his leg was blown off, he was thrown through the windshield, he was killed instantly. The other two guys were grievously wounded inside. A train coming the other way stopped and the driver came down, and, you know, people came from all around to try to render assistance. One of the men died on the scene. The other one was made it to hospital, but he died soon after. So they'd been after, the crooks had been after, and the driver of the train had seen the two men inside this vehicle helping themselves to this cash, which had been blown every which way. Mm. So he got a good look at them. They ran away, tumbled down a hill and disappeared. So there'd been £11,000 in the safe. The safe was welded to the chassis and it hadn't been blown free. So the only money that was actually available to the crooks was money that was out of the safe, which was going to be handed out at the next stop. Maybe £1,000, which was $100,000 at the time, adjusted for inflation. But, you know, a triple murder. And again, you know, the police, detectives and police swarmed the scene. They gave it as much publicity as they could, but, you know, this would have been front page news on any other day. It was relegated to page four because, of course, you know, all the front pages were about Pearl Harbor and the war in the Pacific. And, you know, the police are appealing to witnesses to come forward to, you know, if they've seen anyone or anything suspicious, anyone acting out of the ordinary, which is a big call for a day where I guess everybody's acting out of the ordinary, because all of a sudden you don't know if you're you know, going to be serving in the war against Japan close to home, or Sydney's going to be bombed. So, yeah, they did as much as they could. They recreated the bombs. They worked out that they'd how they'd been built, what they looked like. They tracked down various suspects. But unfortunately, it all went nowhere. I mean, eventually the cops, a decade later, would say that they knew who it was and had identified him and always suspected him. I dug into this guy's files, Lionel Charles Thomas, and there was absolutely no way it was him, because he was actually in the army at this time in Darwin. So another cold case in the sort of shadow of the Pearl Harbor attack.
Wow. Michael, terrific to talk. Thanks for telling the story.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.